Hello, this is Joe Shirey. I'm here at TechEd here in Los Angeles, and today I've got with me Rocky Latka. Rocky is a good friend from the RD program, and thought we'd chat a little bit today about some of the things he's doing here at TechEd and some of his thoughts around frameworks and code reuse. So welcome, Rocky.
Thank you.
Rocky, I know most people know who you are in the community, but for those who don't, can you tell us a little bit about what you do, who you work for, something about yourself?
Sure. I'm the principal technology evangelist for Magenic Technologies. Mm-hmm. And Magenic is one of the largest Microsoft-only consulting companies in the U.S. So I get to do a lot of cool stuff, talking Excellent. To customers. And but I've also, kind of on a sideline, over the last 10 or 12 years, written quite a number of books on building software with COM and now .NET. And mm-hmm. as an outgrowth of that, ended up creating this CSLA.NET framework,
Excellent.
Which is one of the most widely used frameworks on the .NET platform. So,
fantastic. So, what are you doing here at TechEd? Are you speaking at some sessions or doing anything while you're here at TechEd?
Well, I've done a few panels,
mm-hmm.
and that's fun. Panels are always interesting.
Yes, they are.
And I also did a talk earlier today on sharing code between .NET and Silverlight.
Excellent. One of the panels I saw that you were talking about was about software development in lean times, which seems to be a very a topic that's on top of everybody's mind. And one of the things when I think about lean times and development when we've got to deliver more for the business that kind of ties with what you've done with CSLA is framework development and people leveraging frameworks to help speed development. I'm kind of curious about your opinions about the usage of frameworks in the development lifecycle, and when you think they might be appropriate, when they might not be appropriate?
Well, I think ultimately reusable code is the key, because what we're looking for in the end is productivity
mm-hmm.
and being able to do more work in less time or better quality work in less time.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously lean times just make that
Absolutely.
Ever more important than, but it's always important. And frameworks are just one technique for reusing code, reusing expertise, and so I don't think they're a silver bullet. I don't think it's the only answer, but certainly I think when you start approaching some sort of software development effort, any time that you find that you're like writing the same thing twice,
right?
To me, that just calls out for either a tool or a framework or both.
Absolutely. You mentioned there's some other techniques. I'm kind of curious what other techniques you might recommend to developers into kind of the today's times that also help keep the cost down.
Well, I think probably the dominant one that comes to mind is code generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, you know, through much of my career, I would have been an anti, it's like code generation. Nobody's going to generate code as good as I'm going to write.
Right.
But the reality is that code generation, because so much of our code, especially in a business application, does turn out to be relatively repeatable, I guess, right? You know, lots of property declarations, lots of stored procedure calls, you know, these sorts of things. Why should I write all that?
Right.
Why not have a tool write it? So that's one thing. And then the other is that we've seen over the last, I would say, probably 5 or 6 years in particular, the code generation tools and concepts really mature in ways that make them interesting.
Right.
You know, template-driven code generators and so forth. And so now the generators are, in fact, writing the code that I would have written. and maybe that's okay then.
Yeah, I find it interesting. If you go back a couple of years ago, I remember talking to some folks at Microsoft before I joined because I kind of believed in code generation. I still do. At that time, I was still a believer in code generation. And it was kind of this anti-code generation philosophy where, you know, why generate code? You can write code, mm-hmm. and you should be writing code and not let some tool take care of it because you don't know what's under the covers. And that philosophy has really changed, seeing that some of these tools are now built into Visual Studio to do some of this templating and
right.
code generation for you. So it's a pretty interesting paradigm shift.
Well, and I think that the other thing that enters in with code generation to me, and touches on what you're saying, that makes it really, I guess, more palatable, is that people are building code generation into the build process.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Visual Studio actually, in a sense, started this with the Windows Forms generator or designer and the Web Forms designers that are really just code generators.
That's true.
But we don't see the code they generate, at least not normally. And they regenerate constantly, and so you're not even tempted to go tamper with it. And this was, I guess, my failing or worry is earlier in my career, I watched people using case tools or similar things that were, again, basically code generators. But they'd run them, tweak the results, and then you could never run them again. And the result was really quite bad.
And well, and you had code that really nobody but the person who wrote the code generation templates in the first place really knew how it worked. So starting to see a lot better tools, a lot better support for code generation and making it a much more usable technique for writing systems. So one of the things, and you mentioned already, was CSLA.net. How did you kind of come to the conclusion that a framework for development was kind of the right thing to do to extend on some of the writings that you'd done in your books?
Well, it's almost accidental. If you get right down to it, I started writing these books originally back in the COM and VB5, VB6 time frame. And I didn't set out to write a framework. I really set out to describe one technique that I'd found that worked really well to build client-server applications. But in the end, even then, you had to fill in some gaps to make it really work. And of course, now in the .NET platform, the same is true. In order to kind of achieve the end goals that I wanted to write about in my books in terms of how to build these apps, I ended up kind of building helpers here and helpers there. And if you build enough of these things, then you end up with something that feels like a framework. And as a side effect of the books, of course, I would release this code as sample code. And next thing you know, I've got people saying, hey, I'm using your framework. I said, I have a framework? that's kind of how it evolved. And so when I did create the .NET version, I really treated it much more like a framework than I ever did. And by the time we get up to 2004, I suppose, in that I really had adopted ideas around source control and change control and so forth that, the kind of rigor you would hope. But up until that point, at least in my mind, these were artifacts of a book. And now since then, it's really flipped where for the last probably 6 years, it's a framework that I happen to write books around.
Interesting. Very interesting. It's kind of interesting to me also that in the .NET world, VBCOM days and .NET world, we really didn't have a lot of frameworks that came out of the community at all. Everybody was waiting to see what Microsoft produced. So it's interesting to see one that actually kind of rose above the crowd of things that people were doing and get the adoption that it did. I know when I go into a lot of my customers, they look at things as I don't see anybody who really doesn't think that having a framework to base their development on isn't a good idea. And I generally see two different strategies. I see the strategy of grab a framework off of the shelf, whether it's CSLA or patterns and practices frameworks, or build their own framework. And I'm kind of curious of what you think the pros and cons are as you take a look at those in terms of building your own, rolling your own, versus taking something that already exists out there.
Well, I think there's a couple factors that play in. One is do you have the skills and do you have the time and the resources? Because building a framework is certainly not free. And using a framework over a long enough period of time can compensate for that. But honestly, going out and getting just picking up a framework like CSLA or some of the patterns and practices framework components, that's not free either. Because for all the value they bring, you have to figure out how to use them effectively. So either way, frameworks in and of themselves, I think, are only useful if they get used over a long enough period of time, hopefully across multiple applications, so that you get some level of consistency. But then it really does come down to a couple things where do you have the skills to really create a framework? And I guess, creating frameworks is fun to an awful lot of people.
Well, I dig it. Everybody I talk to likes to create their own framework, it seems like.
But I also think you've got to look at the kind of your business and application requirement. for instance, the Prism framework that WPF and Silverlight helps you create some pretty sophisticated user experiences, and it's pretty cool.
Right.
But it comes with some attendant complexity.
Right.
Because it's helping you create some pretty darn cool UI stuff. And if I'm going to build an application that doesn't, I need some reusable pattern for my UI, but I don't need something that's all fancy.
Right.
Prism might be overkill, and I might be able to spend 1 or 2 weeks of time and create my own almost like mini framework.
Right.
Right, that gets me going. And if that meets my needs, that's probably going to be cheaper than taking a dependency on something, you know, that's more big and complex.
I think that makes total sense. So, in those scenarios where organizations or development teams think that, well, if I wanted to create my own little mini framework, what are some of the things you might tell them about how to be better positioned for success in doing that? Because I know sometimes, you know, people will create these things and they won't end up getting the reuse that they expected. They they kind of expected a bunch, and once they create it, it doesn't get there. Usually the pattern I see is they create it without ever solving the problem in the first place. They create this Uber framework that is supposed to solve every problem, problems that they never even encounter.
Yes.
But so I'm kind of curious, since you've been through this process and revved it over the years, I'm curious, what advice would you give somebody, even if it's a little 2 or 3 week project, to create a mini framework to support their development efforts?
I think there's a couple kind of key things. One, don't overthink the plumbing. CSLA continues to grow and expand, but only because there's specific scenarios or issues that I encounter or users encounter where I can say, clearly if I add this, I can add you value. Here, I could add you value, but it's so much work on my part, it's not worth it, and there are other solutions. And especially if you're creating just a small mini, like a mini UI framework, like you really have to control the scope and only tackle the minimum problem space to solve your particular problem.
Right.
And then the other thing that at least I use as a technique for this is when I'm confronted with a problem, I will try and derive a solution out almost in a vacuum. I suppose you call it a proof of concept, whatever, but
right.
I'll run through the problem once, not thinking framework, just thinking...
Solve the problem.
Is this an elegant solution?
Right.
And when I get done, I look at it, I'm like, not so elegant. And I might take another run. I might do that 2 or 3 times. And hopefully I see 1 or 2 of these that I think, that's pretty elegant. So now I'll build a framework around, that's even a strong word, I'll formalize. Often, quote unquote framework, just define a couple of interfaces and an API, and I'm done.
Right.
Right. But I did that because I've experimented and decided this is an elegant answer.
Right. And I've always I've always preached to people when they go down this path, they need to solve the problem 3 times.
Fair enough.
And once you solve it the 3rd time, then you start to see those patterns that are going to emerge that you can pull out into kind of its own shared library, its own means and mechanism.
Well, and I do this because the temptation for me, and I suspect this is true for a lot of people, but boy, I like this stuff, obviously, right?
Right.
And I can get caught up in deep, deep thinking, and I can spend hours and hours. I often do it taking long evening walks. I'll take my dog around the neighborhood, and I'm thinking and I'm thinking, and then I come back and... But that's where you can get trapped.
Right.
You can really overthink it and come up with a solution that's a lot more complex than what you really needed.
Yep. Yeah, I find it funny how often people want to over-engineer their solutions. It's not just in frameworks, but in their development in general.
That's true.
It's one of the reasons I do like a lot of the stuff that comes out of the Agile methodologies to inhibit some of that. I noticed that you're speaking this week also on sharing code between... Silverlight and non-Silverlight type of applications.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm kind of curious to some of your approach that you're taking on that helps people be able to get some of that reuse, because that's been a difficult problem for people to solve.
Well, I think it's a necessary thing, because if you're going to build Silverlight applications that have a server component, and I suspect most will, certainly business apps will, you end up in a position where I want to run some business logic, whether it's validation or calculations, or a variety of things on the client, because I can get a good interactive experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a variety of reasons, I might need to run that same code on the server.
Right.
Either I decide I don't trust the client, that's a common one,
mm-hmm.
or I also have web pages. I mean, it's a hybrid application, and I want to run that same code behind a web page as I do in the Silverlight. And I don't want to copy-paste the code.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the solution, at least today, is a relatively simple thing, which is that Visual Studio supports the concept of linking files mm-hmm. from one project into another. So the file exists on disk exactly one time, but it gets compiled into the Silverlight DLL
right.
and the .NET DLL.
Right.
And the Patterns and Practices group, out of the Prism effort, almost like a side project, created something called the Project Linker, which is a Visual Studio add-in
right.
That allows you to, in Visual Studio, right-click on a project and say, tell you what, I want you basically to suck in all the files from this other project.
Right.
It's the same technique. You can do it by hand.
Right.
This just makes it an awful lot easier.
Interesting. Anything people need to watch out for when they're doing some of that, or does the compiler take care of most everything for them?
Oh, there's a fair number of things you've got to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being that while Silverlight looks like it's .NET, it's actually not.
Right.
It's not only is it a subset of .NET, but it's different. There are base class differences. There are interfaces that are, I suppose you'd say, only partially there
mm-hmm.
Or not there at all.
Right.
And I at least approach this from the perspective that I expect I've got a large base of .NET code already.
Right.
And so with as little effort as possible, I want to take that code and reuse it and without copying it, right,
mm-hmm.
but actually leverage it in Silverlight.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's a fair number of things where you might, on the Silverlight side, have to essentially spoof attributes or implement your own versions of missing .NET interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And often you do this, they don't actually have to do anything.
Right.
Right, because they might not be relevant on the Silverlight side,
mm-hmm.
but your code can't compile without them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, CSLA for Silverlight has quite a lot of this in it. Exactly for that reason.
Interesting. And I've started to see people go down that path, and it's amazing to me how people always think that they go in at the thought position that the .NET runtime and the Silverlight runtime are the same runtimes, and not thinking they know it's a subset, but they think they're the same.
It doesn't really click,
yeah.
until you get into it.
Yeah.
But you know, with some effort. And I don't mean to diminish this effort in terms of kind of mocking up these interfaces and things like that, but it's not an overwhelming effort either. At least in the case of CSLA, we're able to take existing business object code, tweak it slightly, but somewhere in the order of 80% of that code just works.
Wow.
And I don't think we're alone in that. I think again, people that put in that thought and effort. But that's encouraging,
it
right?
is, yeah.
Because it means that although Silverlight is a big leap, it's maybe not quite as big as it might at first seem.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you were able to spend the time with us today. I really appreciate it. I always love talking with you, and you always have such a pragmatic approach to things that it's always kind of refreshing. So,
great, thank you.
Hope you had a great time this week, and appreciate it.
Good. Thanks.